ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Arundhati Roy is a giant of literature. She's also my guest today on The Book Show. Claire Nichols with you, bringing you some of my favourite interviews and favourite books of 2025. Now, Arundhati Roy is the author of two novels, including the Booker-winning The God of Small Things. She's also a prolific writer of non-fiction, much of which confronts injustice in her home country of India. But before she was a novelist, Arundhati Roy was a daughter, and her latest book is a memoir which examines her complicated relationship with her mother, Mary Roy. Mary was a trailblazer in education and in fighting for equality for women in India. But as a mum, she could be cruel, even violent. She died in 2022, and in the book, Arundhati Roy writes, "Perhaps more than a daughter mourning the passing of her mother, I mourn her as a writer who has lost her most enthralling subject." The book is called Mother Mary Comes to Me, and Arundhati Roy is here. Arundhati, welcome.
Thank you, Claire.
You didn't normally call her mum or amma. What did you call your mum most of the time?
Well, early on, my mother left my dad when I was just about to turn three. And later on, she started a school, a small school, which then, you know, has grown into a very, very beautiful school. But when we were children, she didn't want other children to feel that her own children were privileged in any way. So we were to call her Mrs. Roy. In public, she said, but there was no private because the school was in the house and the children were in the house. And so I always thought of her as Mrs. Roy. And so she remains in the book, Mrs. Roy.
It's very formal.
Yes, it's very formal. And ironically, later on, when you know, she was amazing in terms of how she could change and adapt and so on. So later on, the children in her school now would call her Mary Ammachi. Ammachi in Malayalam means grandmother, you know. So Mrs. Roy to her own children became Ammachi to the children in her school. So that was an irony, actually.
So tell me more about this school, because the school is still standing. It sounds like this incredible place that she built over such a long time.
Yes, it's a magical place. And I often used to wish I was her student and not her daughter. Because, you know, as I say in the book, you know, so often there are people who have a calling, you know, whether it's musicians or whether it is writers or whether it's politicians. And often that calling sort of doesn't include parenthood. The only problem was my mother's calling was about other people's children, not hers. But it's such a beautiful school, which started, it started with seven children in the rented premises of the Rotary Club of Kottayam. And I used to think of it as a sliding folding school because we had to go in, you know, unfold the folding tables, put out these little stools and so on. And it was a school. And once we finished, we had to stack it all back and slide away. And then the men would come and meet the Rotary Club in the evening, and then they would leave a filthy mess and the cigarette stubs and the dirty glasses, and we would come back in the morning, sweep it all up, clean it all up, be a school, and then slide away again. So that's how it started. But then it just became so popular in that little town that she, you know, she raised some money, bought a little bit of land, met this extraordinary architect called Laurie Baker who believed in what he called no-cost architecture, you know. And slowly, slowly, slowly over the years, it has been built into this absolutely magical complex, which is a school with very unusual methods of education. And in fact, just a few days ago, I went there along with all my publishers, so many of my publishers from all over the world, from New York, from London, my God of Small Things publisher. Everybody showed up in Kerala for the launch of the book. I took them to the school and the little kids sang Let It Be. It was, everyone had to be taken away in a bucket because everyone is crying so much.
And of course, that's a nod to the title of the book, Mother Mary yes, Comes to yes. Me. How beautiful.
And all of them sang, like about 25 of them from the age of, I think, 7 to, 15. All of them sang with the little Paul McCartney pout, Let It Be. It was too much.
You sometimes in the book describe the school as a cult because of the way everyone adored your mum, because she wasn't always behaving in quite a proper way, right?
Yeah, it was a cult because everyone was in awe of her. Everyone knew that they were gaining something that town could not offer in a million lifetimes from being in that magical place. But it also came with rage and unpredictability, and everyone was always whispering and wondering what her mood was. And so she was like this culty mother guru figure, and the only two people who were not sort of voluntarily in the cult were my brother and me, but we had to obey until we did not.
So your mum was also a trailblazer. When you were 3, your family moved to this tiny town you call Ooty in the state of Tamil Nadu. Where did you go to live when you moved there?
So my mother belonged to a community, a very tiny minority community called the Sidhu Christians, who only are from Kerala, which is right in the south of India. But she was working, as a secretary, the office that her older brother was working in Calcutta, where she met my father, was a Bengali. She married him and they lived on a tea estate in Assam. And then she realized that he was addicted to alcohol and so on. And so in 1962, when women and children had to evacuate the border districts because of the war with China, she decided to leave her husband and Assam. And we didn't have anywhere to go. So we moved south to Tamil Nadu to this little cottage, which was owned by her father, who was an imperial entomologist, as he called himself. And he was an extremely, extremely cruel man who had left the family, had left his wife and so on. And he had died by then. And I don't know, I think we broke into that cottage because I don't know how we got in there, but it was full of these trunks of these very expensive suits and cufflinks. He was a very vain man, the imperial entomologist. And we lived there until my grandmother and my mother's older brother came there and tried to throw us out by saying that she was a woman and she had no right to her father's property. And then that's when she actually became aware of this law, that really the Travancore Christian Succession Act, which said that a woman could inherit a fourth of what a son could, or 5,000 rupees, which is a pittance, whichever is less. So essentially that she didn't really have any rights. And then she nurtured that humiliation for years and years. And then when she could, she challenged it and won the case for equal inheritance. So that was how it all began, in this us living like fugitives amidst these trunks of opulent clothes and cufflinks that belonged to our cruel but dead grandfather.
And it's amazing that your mother had this drive. She was humiliated by your grandmother and uncle trying to kick you out of the house, and it took her years to successfully challenge that Travancore Christian Succession Act. There must be a huge amount of pride for you there in what she achieved in challenging that.
Absolutely. So that's the crux of the book, that even as a very young child, I could see the public battles that she was fighting for women not for me as her daughter, but certainly for me as a woman. And therefore, you know, there was this part of us that was absorbing the darkness, the cruelty, the insults and all that. And then there was a part that was just watching this big battle in the big world, you know. And that is why, for me, the challenge of writing this book was to write her. Can you write a person that you cannot make up your mind about, you know? And because that is what it was. It wasn't just me making an opinion about her based on how she behaved with me, which was very badly, but I could see and I was in awe of what she was doing in the world and in her school as well.
You write about her mimicking you, criticizing you, hitting you. You know, you've said this book is a project to understand who she was. Do you get a sense of where that cruelty came from?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that the book was to understand who she was. I understood very well who she was from the time I was 3 years old, but it was to communicate who she was. But yes, of course, I understood where the cruelty came from. You know, I could see it like a experiment in a lab, because she was, you know, she came from this very small, conservative, minority, Christian community. She married outside, she got divorced, she came back, she was humiliated by everybody. And the anger, I mean, you know, for instance, in that community, everyone had what is called a Tarawad, that's an ancestral home, obviously a patriarchal ancestral home. And we used to, my brother and I, be called address illatu pillare, meaning the kids with no address, because we had no ancestral whatever. So there was this humiliation that sometimes even we didn't understand, but it accumulated in her and that she unloaded it onto us. But I could see where her anger came from always.
Doesn't make it any easier to take it though, I imagine.
It doesn't. It makes it complicated, but I think it made me grow up fast, and it made me in some ways a writer, you know, because like one half of me was taking the hits and one half of me was taking notes. You know?
What was she like to your older brother?
Well, both of us think that she was worse with the other person. You know, like I think she was worse with him and he thinks she was worse with me. But I think it was harder for him on many fronts because, first of all, he was very slightly older than me, but he did remember my father and he did remember a better life. By the time I came along, that was all gone, you know, like she told me so many times how she tried to abort me, she didn't want me, she wanted to dump me in an orphanage and all this stuff. But, you know, the thing is that like her public battles were for women and therefore, in some ways for me too, whereas they were not for him. And all her bitterness against men she took out on him, even when he was very small, you know. So that was awful.
Yeah, did she watch you call him like a chauvinist pig or something when he was like tiny?
Yeah, yes, yes.
What was his reaction?
He told me he didn't feel anything, you know, and he kept telling me, I don't understand what's wrong with you. Like, why are you so upset? And I was humiliated by the fact that I was so upset despite what happened.
Did your mum support your aspirations to be a writer, Arundhati?
Well, she was the one who taught me how to read. She was the one who told me about things that normal people in that little village would not be talking about, you know, whether it was Kipling, whether it was Shakespeare, whether it was the rise and fall of the Third Reich, whether it was A.A. Milne, whether it was Paul Robeson, whether it was slavery or the Mississippi or the Vietnam War.
Your mum would have seen The God of Small Things be published and Ministry of Utmost Happiness, but that was much later in her life. Did she see herself in your novels?
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book in Mother Mary Comes to Me about the launch of The God of Small Things in her school. And, you know, she was meanwhile having this big legal battle with her brother, who's a Rhodes Scholar, but then came back to Kerala to run a pickle factory. And the battle was the school versus the pickle factory. And he was not allowed into the campus, but he came anyway. She was very proud of the fact that one of her students had written this book, but she wasn't very happy that it happened to be her daughter. So it was a ridiculous situation where she was promoting this book and undermining me simultaneously. Then she decided, she would say, I am Ammu in The God of Small Things, because she knew she wasn't. And of course, on the front of the book, I had said, you know, to Mary Roy, who loved me enough to let me go. And my brother says it's the only piece of fiction in The God of Small Things. So
yeah. There's something there, though, right, that, you know, despite it all, you wrote that first novel and you wanted to dedicate it to your mum, even if what you wrote about her in that dedication might not have been exactly right. There's a part of you that wanted to give that book to her.
Well, because there's a part of me that recognized that I am a writer because of her. And in Mother Mary Comes to Me, I say that, you know, she taught me how to write and then raged against the author I became. Not the author I became, but against the fame, you know. Mm. She taught me to be free, then she raged against my freedom. So it was always two things, you know. You know, tear you up, stitch you back. Tear you up, stitch you back.
You didn't become a writer straight away. You studied architecture after finishing school, perhaps inspired by that Laurie Baker who built that beautiful school for your mum. And this time of being away from your mum, how important was this for you to have that space and figure out exactly who Arundhati Roy was?
Well, partly it was I joined the School of Architecture of all the way in Delhi, which is so far away from Kerala, because I was inspired by Baker, but also for a whole lot of other reasons, you know, one being that I knew that if you join the School of Architecture, you can start earning a meager living immediately because you learn to draft, you can work in an office, you can do stuff. And I knew that my life at home was not going to last for long, you know. So I got into the School of Architecture, and I had lived in this very terrifying, sort of, there was this very ominous hum throughout my childhood, which was that, you know, she kept telling me, I'm going to die, I'm going to get asthma, what will you do? You live on the street, no one will take care of you. So I kind of referred to myself as her valiant organ child, because I was her lungs. I was saying, I'll breathe for you. And I kept thinking, if she dies, I'll have to die. What else can I do? And then I just walked through the gates of the School of Architecture, and I saw this, you know, all these stone students and this kind of world, which I felt like I really want to just drop down and kiss the filthy car park and say, okay, I don't have to die. I can breathe for myself, you know. And it just became, I can't even describe it. It was just so wonderful for me. But she immediately sensed that I was not her lungs anymore. I was breathing for me. And that hostility just ratcheted up really, really high. And so by the time I was in my second year, I left. I said, I don't want your money. I'm not coming back. And I didn't say it in a hostile way, but I just couldn't take it anymore, you know.
During this period, you lived this really kind of wonderfully bohemian life, Arundhati. You were poor. You were passionate about what you were doing. You squatted in a campus office. You staged a fake wedding with your boyfriend. You went so you could go and live in a shanty colony. You're right there. You could have easily drifted into a life of addiction to drugs or alcohol or crime. What do you think protected you from that?
Well, you know, I think I said I had an iron angel that protected me. Somehow, you know, I didn't have anybody else. I just had me, and I better look after myself, you know. So, and I also had a father who was an addict, and I also recognizing myself that there's a sort of recklessness which I better keep on a tight leash, you know. And somehow I just held on to it. And also, I suppose I was too interested in so many things. I think I was a very political being by then. There was a lot that I was interested in, too interested in to want to just destroy my life, you know?
Mm. What brought you back to writing?
Once I joined the School of Architecture, you know, I just spent a lot of my early life just thinking about money. How am I going to survive the week? How am I going to pay this rent? How am I going to manage? And writing just didn't seem to be remotely any sort of possibility, you know. And then after I finished architecture, I'd already, you know, become very interested in urban planning. I was already hostile to the idea of being some architect building houses for rich people. I went off to Goa and started selling cake on the beach. And then I got sick of these tourists and so on. Came back to Delhi, joined the National Institute of Urban Affairs. And while I was there, Pradeep, who became the love of my life, and you know, he walked in there because his wife was my boss, and he saw me and asked me if I would be in a movie he was making. And I was just like, why would I be in a movie? I'm not interested in being an actress or anything. And one of my friends, Carlo Buldrini, whose picture of me is on the front cover of Mother Mary, comes to me, and he was this Italian anarchist who also studied architecture and was living in Delhi. He just, much older than me, and he just took me down. He said, what's wrong with you? I mean, someone has given you an opportunity to do something interesting, to learn something, and you're just being such a bore, you know? Agree. So I did. And then I worked in that movie, and then I became a screenplay writer, production designer, and so on.
Yeah, and then at some point, the novel, The God of Small Things, came to you. I love the way you write about the experience of writing this book. You say, I had hunted down my language animal. I had disemboweled it and drunk its inky blood. I knew that if I could describe my river, if I could describe the rain, if I could describe the feeling in a way that you could see it, smell it, touch it, then I would consider myself a writer. What was it like to have this moment of finding your language to write this novel?
You know, I, as a screenplay writer and a production designer, I learned to write dialogue, to structure stuff, but I felt restricted by the fact that the atmosphere would just be described as exterior day rain, or, you know, interior day drawing room, or exterior day river. And also, the movies that I had written, one of them was written for a British television company, and, you know, whatever the meager fees was in pounds translated to a lot of money in rupees in India. So for the first time, I had a little leeway, you know, like I could just sit down and ask myself, but what do you want to write about? You know, what is it that fills your head? And obviously, Kerala just started to parade before me, and I began to write The God of Small Things. And the pleasure that writing that prose, which I called stubbornly visual but unfilmable, you know, and working alone, of not negotiating with anybody, with actors, with producers, with directors, nothing. I just was like, I'm going to control this. And even if it's read by 200 people or one person, I'm going to write it how I want to write it. What it did to me was, really, the search for language is a search for sanity. That's what it is. It's a search for letting the blood flow in your veins and not clog up, you know?
In the introduction, I read an excerpt from your book where you called your mother, Mary Roy, your most enthralling subject. You've now dedicated this whole book to her, Mother Mary Comes to Me. Now that you've finished this project, do you think you will keep coming back to your mother, Mary Roy, in your writing? Do you think she's going to keep appearing in various guises?
I have no idea. You know, when I write something, it's like I have to just empty myself, and then I don't know what's going to happen next, or how I'm going to be, or what I'm going to write, or if I'm going to write, I don't know.
Well, you know? Whatever you do, I'm looking forward to reading what comes next. It is always such a pleasure to speak to you, Arundhati Roy. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. I must come to Australia someday. It's been a long time.
We would be very happy to have you. In the meantime, we can read your book. It's called Mother Mary Comes to Me. It's published by Hamish Hamilton. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National, where Colin McCann is here now. He's known for novels including Paragon, Let the Great World Spin, and Transatlantic. His latest is Twist, and this is a book, and I mean this in the best possible way, it is refreshingly old-fashioned. It's a proper story about a mysterious sailor, the journalist trying to figure him out, and the cables that run beneath the waves, keeping us all connected. Colin McCann, it's great to have you on The Book Show.
Such a pleasure.
Let's talk about cables, because it turns out that underwater cables are what keep us all connected. Can you explain?
Isn't that bizarre? I was stunned when I found out that 95% of the world's intercontinental information travels at the bottom of the deep blue sea or the deep black sea, whichever way you want to put it. I thought that everything shot up in the air and it was all celestial, and then it sort of came back down from satellites. Turns out satellites are slow and satellites are expensive, and nearly everything that we have goes in these very small tubes, no bigger than a garden hose, at the bottom of the sea.
When did you find out about this? How did this information come to you?
So just sort of at the start of the pandemic, I was looking around. I'd finished a novel called A Paragon, which is about Israel and Palestine, and there was all stuff going on. And I thought, okay, I'm going to write about repair. That's the theme of the times. We're living in these broken times. We're all shattered. So, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to try and write a simple story about repair. Well, guess what? It wasn't quite so simple, and it wasn't really just about repair, because it's about repair and sabotage and all sorts of things. But really it came along at the start of the pandemic.
So you wanted to write about repair, and that kind of sent you down this rabbit hole of these cables.
You know what it's like, right? You start on one thing and then you end up half an hour later saying, how in the world did I get here? You know, I was stunned to find that, you know, these cables can get broken. Yes, it makes sense that they get broken on land, or even at a landing station, or even close to shore when these fishing trawlers. But what happens when a cable gets broken and it's 6 kilometers down? There's no way that you can send a diver. There's no way that you can send a robot or a remotely operated vehicle. What you have to do, believe it or not, is the ancient method of taking a rope and basically a grappling hook, and you scour the ocean floor for this cable that may be buried in sediment from a landslide, or it could have been torn apart by an earthquake. And it takes a long time. So it struck me that if somebody really wanted to sabotage the world, they could take out some of these deep sea cables.
Have you seen this in action? Have you seen this kind of rope and grappling hook thing in real life?
Yes. Yeah. I went down to South Africa. So the book, you know, starts in South Africa. It's an Irish narrator, takes place off the west coast of Africa. It's kind of a retelling of The Heart of Darkness in a certain way. In a way, it's a comment on the sort of new colonialism of information and everything traveling, everything that we are sort of owned at the bottom of the sea. So I wanted to go out on one of these boats for a few days, but it was fascinating to see exactly how it worked. It's men, mostly men. There's a couple of women. You know, some of them are idealists. Some of them are just looking for money. Some of them are sailors. Some of them are engineers. Some of them are super smart scientists who are, you know, fusing these tiny cables together. Guess what? Yes, the cables are the size of a garden hose, but inside the fiber, now I don't have any hair left, but inside the fiber is the size of one of your hairs or an eyelash.
Wow.
The fibers that hold all of our information, our ones and zeros, our football scores, our financial transactions, $10 trillion of them a day, all of these things that are going on is contained by light that goes through an eyelash. That to me is a miracle.
Yeah. And so you've got these engineers on board fixing these wires, but first you've got to get them up from the ground, yes, as you say. Something that really struck me in the book was this concept of, you know, that talk about a needle in a haystack. You know, you're just kind of running this grappling hook along the bottom of the ocean, trying to find this wire. There's a scene in the book where I think it goes on for about a week of them just going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But you can't give up. You have to find it, and you have to believe that you will find it, because there is no other choice but to find it. I mean, that's an incredible mindset for these people to be in.
It is incredible. I mean, you can change it, but you'd have to spend $4 billion laying a brand new cable and maybe take 4 years to do it. So why not spend a couple of weeks out at sea searching for the needle in the haystack? Look, there's only 450 cables, working cables in the world. That's really not a lot. Mm. And that carries all of our information. And the internet is what they call self-healing. So you cut one, the information goes around another. But if you're strategic about it, you could take out the continent of Africa with two boats.
Wow.
Which is really startling to think. Actually, because I have no idea how many landing stations there are in Australia, but I know they're peppered all along the coast, and that in certain areas they can be taken down relatively easy. Now, landing stations are things that are on the beaches there, and they're like little bungalows. And guess what? They're hardly protected at all. They might have a chain link fence around them, and they might have a camera here and there. But I've gone to landing stations in South Africa, in Ireland, and in New York, where I stood above the manhole cover and I could have taken a crowbar and I could have lifted it up and touched the wires that were going underneath with the whole pulse of the world, really, when you think about it. Like all these love letters and all these silly emojis and then all these serious transactions that are also going on. And they're right there. And guess what? You could even be laying your towel out on the beach there in Perth or whatever. And suddenly you'd realize that all this stuff is actually going underneath you, maybe 3 or 4 feet underneath you. It's really bizarre. And it's also quite open. Also, divers can get at this stuff at a fairly, you know, low depth, up to about 100 meters, maybe even 200 meters divers can get there. Then you get into the deep, deep, deep sea. But trawlers pull these things apart. And guess what? There's a lot of stuff going on right now in the Baltic Sea. Chinese ships, Russian ships. It sounds like an espionage novel, but it's not. It's real life. It's happening to us right now.
You mentioned colonialism earlier. The roots of these cables, they kind of follow traditional colonial trading routes. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Around Africa in particular, it's kind of chilling. You know, they follow the routes that the slave ships took. And then when you really start to think about what is happening with us, I don't really understand it, but I do know that, you know, our machines, it's not the machines that are a problem. It's my relationship to the machines. But the machines are being manipulated so that I'll get a squirt of dopamine in my brain every time I go through a video. And there are people behind the curtain who are sort of controlling this. And so this whole thing did become a metaphor for the heart of darkness. There is a sort of Kurtz-like figure. Also, what happens in the book is that, and this is based on a true story, it's the Congo River that floods. Now, rather than us going up the Congo River, it's everything that comes down from the Congo River. And it's climate change that causes these rains, that causes these landslides, and then it interrupts us out at sea. And people have to go out and try to repair it. But who's making the money from all of this? Who's making some of the decisions? You know, who is owning our information that is like zipping along in all those ones and zeros beneath us? And, you know, one day, hey, maybe it'd be a good thing if we could wake up without our internet. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't be able to do things like talk to you, so I say no.
You know what's happening right now is that my voice and your voice is bouncing underneath the sea. I'm in New York, you're in Australia, and everything that is occurring is occurring in billions of pulses of light per second, and yet it only takes a fraction of a second. We feel like we're talking to each other in real time. It's kind of a miracle. It's either the most ordinary thing, like we accept electricity, or it is an absolute miracle.
Okay, so the book is called Twist. Our chief repairman is John A. Conway. So he's the chief of mission on one of these repair boats. And I love the description of him on the opening page. It says, "For the most part, he moved quietly and without much fuss. But his was a lantern heart full of petrol. And when a match was put to it, it flared." I mean, what beautiful writing, Colin. But what do we need to know about this man?
Well, this man is a bit of an enigma, and much of the novel is about the sort of loneliness of modern man. I know I mentioned Heart of Darkness, mm-hmm. but there's also echoes there of, you know, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, T.S. Eliot, and all those lonely men in shirt sleeves hanging out of windows. And there are specific echoes actually in that poem about, you know, "I've heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think they will sing to me." And, you know, "until human voices wake us and we drown." So there are a lot of echoes of that. There are sort of tiny echoes of Great Gatsby too.
I noticed those.
First. Thank you. But so for me, I tend to experiment a good deal. My last book, A Paragon, was about Israel and Palestine. It was in 1,001 chapters. It was, you know, it pushed the edge. This is a fairly straightforward book, I think, in certain respects, or at least apparently straightforward, because it's got a single narrator. He's Irish, you know, he's middle-aged. He's not me, but he could be me. You have a straight chronological time. And then you have a sort of mystery at the heart of all of this. So in many ways, I wanted to go back to a sort of simplicity, because I do believe that we've gotten away from some forms of storytelling, and that, you know, we need to return to, you know, a good old fashioned yarn every now and then.
I must say, there was something surprising to me about this book. As someone who reads about 3 literary fiction novels a week, to pick up a book.
A week.
To pick up. To pick up a book that had, from the first page, here is a character, here is a story, let's go.
Right.
There was something so refreshing about reading something which in its essence is kind of old-fashioned, Colin. It kind of feels like everything old is new again.
Yeah, well, I really did set out to do that, but I soon discovered that that nothing is simple, especially simplicity, you know. It became quite difficult. Even though the character was Irish, and even though he was a journalist, and even though, you know, he had all these things that supposedly had access to me and my own imagination, he ended up being so different and cantankerous, and he never quite solves everything for me. Nabokov used to say that his characters were his galley slaves. You know, he would make them do whatever he wanted them to do. I wish I could be Nabokov, but I'm not. I am totally like steered by my characters, and they do these weird, crazy things, and I can't get them to do anything else. But it was fun. It was fun doing that. But like every novel, I sort of gave it up halfway through. And I think we do that because we kind of want to fall in love with the book again. And when you go back again, you know, you go in and you repair it, because, you know, as I said, you know, so much of the book is about repair, and it's about these shattered times that we live in. I'm interested in this. What is the Japanese notion? I think I'm going to like butcher the term, but do you know kintsugi?
This is where you mend a broken piece of pottery with the gold paint. Yeah, and you make it more beautiful.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, is it possible? This is incredibly, dangerously, stupidly optimistic of me, especially given the politics that we're in right now. But is it possible that we can take all of these shattered pieces and make a mosaic out of them and somehow put them together and make them more beautiful than they were originally? I mean, I like the construction that the Italian social scientist Gramsci talks about, being a pessimist of reality, but an optimist of the will.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the world is really, really, really dark, but so what? It's not good enough to be a cynic. How can you sort of get out of it? But I did find myself getting dark with this book. I did find myself like, ooh, we're going to the bottom of the deep blue sea with all of this stuff.
You mentioned, you know, you had to walk away for a while. Like, how long did you leave this before you were ready to come back?
Oh, I'm such a pain in the rear end. You should hear me walking around my house and my kids go, oh, there goes Daddy breaking up with his book again, you know. I did it a few times. I actually even wrote another book in between. So I started Twist shortly after the pandemic. And then I wrote another book called American Mother, where I spent a year with them, Diane Foley, who's the mother of James Foley, who was the journalist who was killed in the desert. Completely different story. So one is fiction, the other one's nonfiction. But there are certain things where they came together. And when I came back to it, it flowed. To come back in a little sheepishly with my head held low. But, often that's the way. Often that's the way with books. I remember giving up Let the Great World Spin, for instance, thinking, I can't do this. I can't. This is too much. And I think I've basically done it with every single book, except actually the one that I did quickly, which was American Mother, the one that came in the middle of Twist.
Do you know, it's so interesting to hear about you having these moments of self-doubt, walking away, because I've always considered you quite a prolific writer, Colm. I feel like books of yours arrive on my shelves quite quickly. And I was having a look at one of the books I have here, Letters to a Young Writer, which is a book of writing advice. And I loved this quote. I'd pulled it out. It says, a writer is the one who puts his ass in the chair when the last thing he wants to do is to have his ass in the chair. I mean, is this part of it to just go, look, I don't know what I'm doing, but just sit down and make something come?
Yeah, well, I think the great lie about writing and about writers is that we know what we're doing. And the thing is that you operate on a wing and a prayer. And I do think it's about how much stamina you have. That old Beckett line, can't go on, must go on, is really, really, really important. And when you face the terror of the blank page, you know, that's when you do it. And sometimes it's just a big fight. You wrangle with this thing and you're hoping, okay, is this gonna work this time? But putting the arse in the chair, look, it's not going to happen unless you're there. You know, it's all about like cutting it and working on it and working and working. And then suddenly it's a pile at one stage. And then when you come out at a year or so later, oh, it's not so bad anymore.
Twist by Colm McCann is published by Bloomsbury. This is The Book Show. And when I think of my favourite books of 2025, I have to go right back to the start of the year when I read Fire Exit by the American writer Morgan Talty. Now, to picture this one, I want you to first imagine a river in Maine. This river is a border, and on one side is a Native American reservation of the Penobscot people, and on the other side is a house. Sitting on the porch is a single white man, Charles. He grew up on the Penobscot Reservation, but now he sits and watches a house on the other side where his daughter, Elizabeth, now lives. And Elizabeth has no idea that Charles is her dad. This is a book about blood and family. It's beautiful. Morgan Talty, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is such a powerful image, this idea of the man staring across the river at the life he could have had. We'll get into why Charles can't be a father to Elizabeth soon. But I just wanted to talk initially about that image, Morgan, and how you landed on this beautiful river separating this man and his life.
Fortunately, life, the real life, kind of helped shape all of my fiction I kind of set in this world, because the Penobscot Nation itself is an island that is in the Penobscot River. There's tons of islands, you know, along the Penobscot River in Maine. But our reservation is one island and there's a bridge that, you know, connects it. And so I'd always just had drawn from that, you know, real life. I think from the very beginning, I had the idea of having Charles be on the other side. And the question was, it's like, how did he get there? But I don't try to think too symbolically about things. You know, I just try to pay attention to what people want and what they're doing and those sorts of things. But it's clear, you know, there's this literal divide and it's this movement, you know, of water, right? Seasonally changing, freezing, kind of just like his life throughout that whole, throughout the whole book. So it suited it well.
It's beautiful. You were talking about, you know, our reservation. So you are a member of the Penobscot Nation. You grew up on the reservation, Morgan?
I did. Yep. Yeah. So I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut. For some reason, there's a fair amount of Penobscot people in Connecticut. You know, it's about 7 hour drive away from the reservation. I don't know why, but like, I was born there, and then I moved to the reservation when my mom and my dad got divorced, and I spent, you know, the whole year on the reservation, and then I go visit my dad for a summer. But yeah, I grew up on the reservation until I was 18, from like age 5 or 6, and then my mom moved off, and I've moved, you know, farther away, but I'm still involved virtually in this world, or this digital age now. Or I have to go over there and I go and visit family and stuff.
A nice way to be a kid growing up on the reservation?
Oh, God, it was fantastic. I loved it because it was, it's just like, well, small towns, you know, all small towns, like, they know something about you before you do, you know, and like, that's how it is. Everybody who lives on the reservation, at least here, is like, you know, I hate living here. But then the moment you leave, it's like, oh, I don't want to be anywhere else but here. And so I still carry that feeling. But as a kid, it was great because it was still a lot of woods. When we had been placed there, you know, it was just paths, dirt paths and stuff. And then, you know, we kept building and building and building. And even today, they're still putting up more stuff on this 3x2 mile island. It's not very big. It's really small. But my friends and I just loved the woods. We loved being out in nature, you know, hence, I think, Charles and Mary and Gizus, you know, being out in the woods when they're younger. And I had a lot of pages about them out in the woods, but it didn't serve the story. It had to be cut. So
you can save it for the next one.
I can, yeah.
Reading your book introduced me to the concept of blood quantum laws. So in America, this is basically a way of deciding exactly how Indigenous someone is. You become a percentage. You can be half native or quarter native. Now, these blood quantum laws were historically created by white America. And of course, there's a similar story to be told in Australian history here as well. But I was interested to find that this concept of blood quantum laws have been adopted by a lot of Native American tribes as a way to decide who gets to stay, who gets to be a citizen.
Yeah. So blood quantum in the U.S. originated in the colony of Virginia in early 1700s, I believe. It was actually not originally designed for indigenous peoples. It was used for slaves. It was used to maintain, it basically gave white men the right to, you know, rape black women and ensure if the child was a male, you know, it could not inherit. So if there had been any drop of, you know, African blood or black, whatever type of blood, you know, they were designated not white. And somebody was sort of like, well, we could do that with Native people, right? And we could kind of like dilute them. So it spread outward, and tribes were eventually, you know, once they became domestic dependent nations during the Marshall Trilogy in the 1820s, and were considered wards, you know, like to the state, and they were treated as separate nations. You know, the Constitution outlines it that tribes are, and, you know, but sovereignty has been stripped and stripped and stripped. One of the criteria for tribes is that they have to maintain some sort of way of membership, and most tribes use blood quantum. So the history of it has just been meant to dilute and, in my opinion, cause internal conflict within tribes. You know, I always say that we have been internally colonized, but I don't think we've been internally colonized to the point where we can't return. Like, I feel like now is the time, especially during the United States' new administration of presidential power. I think this is a time when tribes really have an immense amount of strength remaining across Indian country that can do good for their tribes, but for everybody, especially with blood quantum and belonging, because there are people out there who I grew up with on the reservation who were like Charles, had no native blood. Their parents had married in. And I'm like, I wonder how they feel. I'm like, they did better than me in Native Studies class when I went to school on the reservation, you know? And I'm like they knew the language better than I did.
So what happened to those friends? So because they didn't have Native American blood, they basically what had to leave the reservation at a certain age? Is that how it works?
Yeah, you can't, if you're not a member of this of the tribe, and if you're not married, if I think you can be dating somebody and there's like some situation like that, but like you can't reside on the reservation. But yeah, so essentially they all ended up leaving. Either they went to school or they went and like worked somewhere. But I've always just thought about how many of my friends have either remained, you know, who are native, you know, they're still there, or they went to other reses, you know, in Canada or, you know, out west and found groups of Indigenous people. But I can't think of any of the ones that I grew up with who are not native, who are still with the types of people they grew up with, like us, you know, where we would throw in English words with Penobscot words, you know, and things like that. So I was like, well, what if there's this non-native guy who has a child with a woman who's only a quarter blood, you know, who has 25% on the census, that would make their child ineligible to be considered native or a member of the tribe. So we have her lie and say it was a different man's child who is native. It's like, that's sort of like the premise. But then the rest of it is like, that's not where the hard work came in. And so if I hadn't thought about law or outside, like those ideas, the book never would have come to me.
Right. So we have Charles. He's a white man. He grew up on the reservation because his mother had married a Native American man. He feels a very deep connection to the Penobscot people, yet he wasn't able to buy land. He's had to move across the river and look back. Then he's got this daughter, Elizabeth.
Yeah. So Charles, you know, understands, you know, he grew up as a little boy, you know, I think he grew up there not even remembering, you know, he was like 2 or 3 years old when his mother married Frederick and, you know, he was raised there. So he knew what it was like to be an outsider in this community and he knew what it was like to have to leave. He wasn't a descendant in the same way Elizabeth, you know, would have been, right? But he knew she would experience some of the, you know, I have more native blood than you type of stuff, which exists, you know, and has been a division for a lot of people in tribe, you know. So I think for him, when Mary is sitting, you know, and tells him essentially what she's going to do, you know, he goes along with it because in my mind, I was like, well, he knows how terrible he must feel. Like it becomes a reflection, I feel like. Like he never says it, but when I read it and I look at it and I'm like, wow, he really suffered from that experience, so much so that he was willing to let his daughter, biological daughter, be raised by this man, other man, until he could no longer go along with it for. So the reasons I think he went along with lying about this and being like, okay, we'll keep it a secret, had a lot to do with how much him being an outsider and having to leave affected him, like how much his sense of belonging really caused a lot of pain, despite the happy childhood he had had, because it's a huge political issue, not just, you know, with reservations, but anywhere in the world where there are physical or invisible lines that separate people.
Well, I'm so glad you did all that work and we get to read this book. It's called Fire Exit. It's by Morgan Talty and it's published by Scribe here in Australia. Morgan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Claire, for having me.
The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. It's produced by Sarah Lestrange with technical operation by David LeMay. My name is Claire Nichols and I'll be back with a fabulous conversation with David Nichols and Leanne Moriarty next week. Until then, take care.